University Forum is a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University, which brings speakers and performers to the campus throughout the semester to lecture on a variety of topics. The opinions expressed by the speakers do not necessarily represent the opinions of Nebraska Wesleyan University or of this station. Today, University Forum presents Paul Loeb, author of the acclaimed books Hope in Hard Times and Nuclear Culture. Loeb's lecture is entitled Hope in Hard Times. For nearly 20 years, Loeb has been exploring both what inspires people to act and what holds them back. His lectures cover the connection between critical global questions and our ordinary lives. Praise for his books and lectures has come from such varied sources as authors Alice Walker and Kurt Vonnegut and economist John Kenneth Galbraith. Join us now for Paul Loeb and University Forum.
I'm very delighted to be here. I actually spent, in the last couple of years, I've been through Lincoln several times and very much enjoyed the city and had the chance to talk to a number of people in the city in terms of the research that I'm doing for the book on current students, mostly over UNL. And so I hopefully will not be just flying in and flying out without any sense of who you are and what kinds of things you're thinking about. What I'd like to talk about today is a sort of juncture between our individual lives and these kinds of large, often overwhelming global issues that surround us. Because I think that as important as the issues themselves are, our response to them is probably even more so. That is to say that questions like the environment or the arms race or the problem of homelessness, none of these will indeed be humanely addressed unless ordinary citizens like yourselves are involved in shaping the decisions that large institutions of our government and corporations and whatnot make. And so what's very much concerned me for this last, I guess, 20-year period now, is the question of how people participate in the world that surrounds them. Now, as mentioned, I spent some time at a place called Hanford, Washington, writing a book called Nuclear Culture. And it was a very interesting community because it was a community that made atomic weapons. And that was pretty much all they did. They had a little bit of nuclear power on the side. And they'd had their birth at the Manhattan Project, the top secret World War II A-bomb effort, so literally kind of sprung up out of a bare desert in eastern Washington and built the first reactors in the world in about 6 months' time outside of the very initial test in Chicago. And you had a little, I guess it was kind of like holding a little magnifying glass under our nation and saying, here's this place where we all think occasionally about the issues like the arms race, but they're usually abstract. Here's this place where people are going in every single day of their lives for 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, making weapons-grade plutonium, and ultimately making the plutonium for about a quarter of the world's arsenals that exist. How do they respond? And what I realized the further I got into that community was that it was not so different from most communities. I mean, there was a few things that were a little bit jarring. They had a high school football team that they called the Richland Bombers, and they had a miniature mushroom cloud on their football helmets and their pep club banners, and they played in the Bomber Bowl, and when you graduated from the school, you got a gold leaf R for Richland and a gold leaf mushroom cloud on top of that. That was a little bit, I don't know, should I say disconcerting? But really, it wasn't so different. When I asked the student body president, he just said it was a cool, aggressive symbol and they won lots of games with it and what's the big deal. And when somebody recently tried to change it to, I don't know what, maybe even a nuclear reactor, just something a little bit less militaristic, they said this is our tradition and we have to hold on to it. A very odd notion of tradition, which says that if you're on a track that's a very unwise track, you simply have to continue indefinitely without ever questioning. And what I realized, though, is that the mindset that clung to the mushroom cloud wasn't, it came out of something. It came out of a accustomedness and to almost a taming of these kinds of technologies, where they said, it's not to say that they mastered them, but because they went in every single day, they felt familiar with this stuff. They felt like it was innocuous. I remember one person who said, you know, it really wasn't any big deal. I could have been making light bulbs. The point is, I was just making machines work. So that, in a sense, they made no distinction between the actions that they did at the labs of Hanford to make the atomic weapons and tinkering in their basements, turning out... Well, one guy built a hovercraft out of surplus irrigation equipment and a salvaged motor and a salvaged automobile body. And to him, it was all the same. You know, you make a machine, it's nice, it works. You make an atomic bomb, what's the big deal? What's the difference? Somehow, it didn't really matter. And that sense that these kinds of decisions and that our choices in them didn't matter really was woven into the culture. And they did this a number of ways. They did this through the routinization, going in day after day after day. They did this through a notion that, I use the phrase, the men who know best, because that's the phrase they used, that says somewhere out here, there's people who understand these things. We can't. Whatever it is, whether it's the arms race or the politics of food or the politics of homelessness, we can't know enough. And so I remember on the anniversary of Hiroshima being toured around a reactor by the director of that reactor, and he was telling me how much, after we sat down and talked, how much she really worried about the bombs, how much she thought that the further things went, the worse it would get, how we had to make some kind of fundamental halt. And I was very confused because this didn't seem to be, it didn't seem to mesh with the work that he was doing, which was making more atomic bomb materials. And so I said, well, does that mean you favor some kind of disarmament, some rolling back? And he says, don't misunderstand me, I'm a patriot. And I said, well, yes, I am also. But that's not what we're asking. We're saying what's wise for our country. And he says, well, if somebody who knows better than I do, who's an expert, thinks we need to build a bomb, thinks we need, he was talking about the neutron bomb and how just horrifying it was to him because it would leave the people dead in the building standing. And he said, you know, if somebody says I need to build a neutron bomb, I have to trust them because they know more than you or I do. So what you had is a very interesting kind of separation, because here's his gut misgivings. He thinks this weapon is horrible, and he's just been telling me about how horrible he thinks it is. And then he says, well, but that doesn't matter, because there's somebody else out there who's an expert, and I've got to trust what they say. And I think that that kind of deferral is very much woven into our culture. One of the interesting things that I've come across when I've been researching this book on students is that, I guess I call it the perfect standard. People talk about getting involved in different kinds of issues, but then they say, I can't know enough. Or they say, the people who are speaking out on El Salvador or the arms race or apartheid or homelessness or whatever it happens to be, they don't know enough. And it's almost as if you have to be able to, I don't know, go on television and be able to debate one-on-one with Henry Kissinger to be able to be given legitimacy for the right to take a stand. And yet I think we've somehow been ingrained in ourselves that it's not to say that knowledge isn't good or that the more we know, the better we are at being able to articulate what we believe. But there's a sense that we make the threshold so high that we never really can take a stand. We never can speak out because there's always some other fact that we don't know. And I would suggest that rather than believing in these absolute hierarchies of the experts, or rather than believing in somehow, you know, the 5 tons of facts on any given issue, that we begin, and I'll talk about that throughout the course of this lecture, to look at the patterns, to try and say, okay, if we're trying to deal with a certain issue, be it styrofoam or the arms race or the agriculture crisis, how does it fit into the pattern of what I know about the world? Because we all know many, many things. How does it fit into my understanding of what's right and wrong, of what choices are more humane and what choices are more degrading? And that being able to proceed in that sense, I think we all can feel much more able to be able to take a stand and act on these kinds of things that matter. Now, let me talk a little bit more about some of the barriers, because it seems to me that unless we understand them and work them through, it is very difficult to act. I'll give you an example very close at home from here in Lincoln, Nebraska. There is a student who I became friends with in one of my research trips over at UNL, who came from, I guess it was a third or fourth generation farm family down in Holdridge. And the life of that family was absolutely linked with the life of the land, and it had been, and it was his great-grandfather's farm and his grandfather's and his father's. And when the ag crisis hit a few years ago, his father got really creamed, as so many other farmers did. And he barely held on. I mean, he didn't completely go bankrupt, but they had to sell a lot of their land, and they had to sell a lot of their livestock. And basically, this was I guess you'd call it an intergenerational trust that had been built up as a legacy, and suddenly, boom, It just got knocked. And what happened? He said, well, you know, it wasn't my father's fault. He was a good farmer. He'd apparently even won some kind of conservation award at one point. He said, but, you know, the little guy just doesn't stand a chance. The corporations like ConAgra and Dow and Cargill, the agribusiness multinationals, they manipulate credit, they manipulate land prices, they manipulate the prices of seeds, the government policies and the subsidies and the tax laws and transportation and storage. He says, you start stacking all that up, somebody like my father just got caught in the crunch. And he said, it was not. You've got to believe me, it wasn't because he was a bad farmer. And I said, well, yes, I do believe you, because it didn't seem to me like somehow all the farmers in Nebraska were wonderful farmers, and then one year they turned into bad farmers. I mean, it was a larger structural problem that created that crisis that hit so many communities so hard. And so we talked on about what he was going to do in his life. And at a certain point, he says, I'm very excited. I've got a summer internship at Dow Chemical. And I said, now, correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't I hear you 5 minutes before say that Dow Chemical was part of what drove your dad out of business? He said, yeah, you did. And I said, well, now I have some particular problems with Dow Chemical because of its history during Vietnam of napalm, making napalm and making Agent Orange. But leave that aside. You're saying, right or wrong, that this company helped drive your father out of business, and you're going to go work for them. What does that mean? He says, I know. It's kind of a problem, isn't it? I said, yeah, sounds like one. He says, well, you see, the way of life that my dad represents is a dead way of life. I like nothing more than being out there on that combine on a nice day in the fields. I love that way of life, but it's just, it's gone. It's not going to be able to continue on. And Dow Chemical is in agriculture. I want to stay in agriculture. And I think what happened was, and this is a very, very good person, you have to understand, it's not somebody who wished anybody ill, but it's a failure of hope and a failure of vision that says we can stand up for what we really want and what we think to be right as opposed to what we have to settle for. And finally he said, you know, I hope I can maybe make some kind of difference from within. And I said, like what? He says, well, you know, sometimes if there's a sleazy salesman, they'll tell somebody to spray for corn borer infestation when it's only 10%. And, you know, you do that, you're going to lose money. And I would never do that. You have to wait till it's really the right amount, and that's when you're supposed to spray. And I said, well, I understand that, but that wouldn't have been your dad's case. He was too smart a farmer, right? He says, no, 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 my dad would never get taken in by anything like that. So essentially, what he's really saying is, he hopes, and I believe him, he sincerely hopes to make a difference. But really the only difference that he can think of to make is he won't be sleazy. And I'm sure he won't. But the normal structural things that go on, how is he going to have a say on them? And so one of the things that I've found very, very disconcerting is that over the last 10 years we've had pounded into us a notion that ordinary people don't have a right to make history. I'll give you an example. When there was a vote in Congress and Ronald Reagan lost one of the initial bills on Contra funding, and he stormed off and he says, I don't understand why a committee of whatever it is, 535, should have the right to determine foreign policy. He meant the U.S. Congress and Senate. And I said, well, my God, if he'd read Thomas Jefferson, he would know why it was set up that we should not take an act like making war on another nation, which is what we were doing, without the largest consensus of our population. And that's why it was not reserved to the presidency to declare war. It was reserved to the Congress. Now, as we know, he went around and Iran-Contra happened, and they basically ignored the will of Congress and did what they wanted to anyway. And clearly Bush was involved in that, and that may or may not come out as Poindexter testifies, depending on what they allow into the kinds of hearing rooms. But the point is, you start hearing that enough times, what happens? You feel like, my God, if a congressman can't have a say, who am I? What right do I have? What difference can I make? I'm just, you know, a student. I'm 20 years old. And I think that's been pounded into us, and it's something that we have to look critically at. I don't know, maybe a tour at some of those busts in the state legislature, Capitol, you know, might give us a sense of some different current of history, because this is certainly a state with a very strong and honorable populist tradition. that says ordinary people, of course they can make history. They're the motor behind it. But we get so that we don't think that that's possible. You know, and so I think of Darren and the compromise, that's the person I was just talking about from UNL, the compromise that he made. And finally what he did is he said, you know, what really concerns me is I want to have a family. There's a woman I'm going to probably marry. I want to make sure that I have enough time home from the road if I'm a salesman. I'm going to try and make my private life as humane and decent as possible. I think a lot of us end up settling for that choice. And it's not a wholly dishonorable choice, obviously. Private life is very important. But at the same time, as his own family bore testament, there are things that happen in the public world that affect us all. And those are the things that fall by the cracks if we don't consciously begin to take them on. Now, how else do we back off from these issues? I think there's a very strong mistrust of common action that's again pounded us into us in the culture. And I remember somebody was in engineering school in upstate New York, and he goes on and on how he doesn't trust, if he gets involved in any kind of issue group, he's going to lose his identity, he's going to get swallowed up, was the phrase I think he used. And you know, his beliefs would go by the wayside and suddenly he'd be part of a crowd and a mob, and he just was really wary of that. Now, I asked what he was going to do. He was going to be working for IBM. And I said, well, isn't this a little bit contradictory? I mean, IBM, I don't know how many people they employ, 200,000, 300,000 worldwide. Somehow they're less intimidating than a group of six of your friends. He said, well, yeah, but they break things down into separate divisions. You know, I won't lose my identity in IBM. Now, I don't know if he totally believed this, but it seems to me that we're willing to raise a different standard, you know, if there's somehow the secure paycheck attached, than we are for activities that we ourselves are taking on the responsibility of choosing and determining. And again, that troubles me, because the fact is that of course one tends to lose your identity in a place like IBM more than you do in a group of five or six of your friends. I mean, you know, common sense would tell you that. But somehow we place it in a different category, and it's exempt, but yet when it comes to trying to act on the common issues of our time, that's when the fear hits. That's when we feel like we'll be swallowed up. And I think we have to think long and hard about how our culture has taught that to us and what that means. It's a kind of, again, backing away from to me, the questions that really matter. Now, it seems to me that if I take the vision of the world that is, I guess, the official vision. I mean, until recently, there was a very clear, and sometimes it changed in the Soviet Union, official line. And it would change maybe month to month, but you would read something and every single paper would say the same thing, and the TV news would say the same thing. And that was the official line of the government, and people didn't necessarily believe it, but that was what we would hear. Now, recently, as we know, all of a sudden, they've really opened up, and suddenly there's a diversity of voices arguing with each other, debating. I mean, that's called democracy. I would suggest that in much more subtle ways, there are official lines in our country. There are official statements, and they go something like this. You are on your own. You have to look after yourself, first of all and foremost. If you don't help yourself, nobody else will. And if change is going to occur, it's going to occur by the people at the top deciding to be more benevolent or far-sighted. It's not going to occur from you. And think about that. Think about all the things that you've heard as you're growing up, you know, in your schools, maybe even in your churches, in your communities. There are other voices that push the other way. Voices like Nebraskans for Peace, voices like some of the churches and temples that have begun to speak out. Voices like perhaps the dialogue that may occur in some of your classes at this school. But I would suggest that the dominant voice is one that essentially separates us from each other and from the problems of the world. And if you think about it, this is again the voice that I've been heard when I'm listening to students as I'm talking. What I hear is this sense that says the world is carnivorous. You know, it chews you up. It would be very nice if, people say. I would like it if, people say. But they don't say that they believe that they can do very much about it. I used to be taking surveys when I would go into classrooms on the arms race and the possibilities of nuclear war, and I would hear people roughly half to two-thirds in any given classroom, I believe, over at UNL across the way. I spoke in a freshman class and did the same poll and got the same results. Half to two-thirds thought that there was a reasonable possibility of a nuclear war in their lifetime. Not that it would necessarily happen, but that it was possible. I don't think that that is such an irrational decision, a rational judgment to be making. I think it is a possibility. I think that indeed our country is continuing to build weapon systems that make it more likely. Very, very accurate systems that threaten the weapons of the Soviets, like the MX missile, like the Trident II missile, like some of the B-2 bomber. I mean, isn't it, you think about the notion of a bomber that nobody can see on the radar screens. That's what it's cracked up to be. And, you know, it seems that in all likelihood it's not that. You know, it's just another $100 billion boondoggle. But you think about what happens if it really does work. What does that mean for stability that the Soviets can't see it? In a time of international tension, say, all of a sudden they decide that one of these bombers that they can't see on their radar screens has come in, and how do they know it's there? They know it's there because they can't see it. Is that going to help stability? Is that going to make them less prone to make some rash decision? Of course not. And yet what happens is that we indeed are beginning to, continuing to, try and prevail, try and get the upper hand, even as they are, in fact, rolling back. As they're saying, let's end this Cold War. There's a radar station that for years our Cold War hawks pointed to and said, you see, that's their version of Star Wars preparation. Well, what did they do? They said, okay, why don't you bring your scientists in here? Why don't you bring your Congress people in here? Why don't you come in and tour it? And if you don't like it, we'll tear it down. They've made that offer. Have we done anything equivalent? So what happens is that we keep pushing forward. Things do get a little bit more precarious, even in the midst of a backing down of the Cold War dialogue. And people perhaps reasonably feel like there is some risk still continuing, because there is. And I asked them then, I said, okay, how many of you think that you can do anything about it? And I look around and I don't see any hands. Where are the hands who said that, yes, they thought that indeed it was a real crisis? They're gone. I remember at Dartmouth, a very prestigious school, certainly. It was an arms control class where I asked this question, and two people raised their hand out of 35. What I'm suggesting, again, is that we have been trained to powerlessness, trained to say all we can do is fit ourselves into the slots, whether it is Dow Chemical or... I remember somebody at a school in Connecticut who said, well, it would be very, very nice if school could be about learning. But, you know, frankly, a corporation is not going to care how much I know about Plato. They're going to care about my grade. It's going to show them that I can do what I'm told to, that I can jump through the hoops. It would be nice if that had something to do with learning, but, you know, the reality is I'm doing it so I can get a good job. And I think that when those judgments are made, we end up selling ourselves short, vastly short. Because what we do is we simply say, again, we can only fit into what exists. We never can have a right to ask and say, how can the world be? How should it be? What can we do to make it the way that we think that it should go? And we know we're living in a time with some very, very interesting developments. On the one hand, there is the, you know, fundamental shift in the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc countries. I mean, what does it mean that Poland suddenly has a non-communist government at its head? It's astounding. Suddenly there's a diversity of dialogue. I mean, and this is something, you know, you talk about people making change under difficult circumstances. You know, strikes and being jailed and persevering for years and years and years in this fight between the Solidarity Movement and a very repressive regime. And all of a sudden they win. Doesn't mean the battle's over, doesn't mean everything's solved, all the crises are gone, but a fundamental shift has occurred in that country. A fundamental shift has occurred in the Soviet Union, opening a tremendous amount of dialogue. I mean, I have read things in their newspapers criticizing their government. I would never read in the New York Times criticizing our government in equivalently strong terms. I saw a film called Repentance, which was a Soviet film that was made about 6 years ago or 5 years ago, promptly banned for very, I suppose, quote, good reasons. It was a dangerous film. It talked about the legacy of Stalin. It talked about how that was linked to what was going on in the present. It's a very good, engaging film cinematically as well, so it wasn't just some dry propaganda piece. And they banned it, and then they finally released it in the year that I believe Top Gun was our best-selling box office film, and it turned out to be the best-grossing film of any in the Soviet Union. That's a shift. And I look at our society, and I hear Bush go on TV and talk about he's going to do this drug bill, and where will we get the money? Well, we'll take some money from youth programs. That has nothing to do with drugs. We'll take some money from homeless programs. That has nothing to do with drugs. We'll take some money from resettling immigrants. And, at least where I live, there's a great many Southeast Asian immigrants. And that was a culture which, in part because of our presence during the Indochina War, was tremendously involved in the heroin trade. So what happens if you cut off the support systems there? What are they going to turn to? Well, there's lots of fields at least they've got some skills in. I look at this and I say, is our culture willing to come to grips with reality? We let the savings and loans just, absolutely feed at the trough. People get tremendously rich, and then it collapses, as those kinds of fraud and speculation schemes often do. Who pays the bill? Well, we do, of course, but we're not even honest enough to put it on this year's budget lines. We get this sort of weird little notion that says, let's put it outside the regular budget so that we can say that the deficit is going down and it'll be its own separate category, and never mind that we're stuck with $100 billion for the next two generations. Seems to me that a great many of the crises in our culture have to do with our inability to simply look honestly at what's going on and say, yes, indeed, this is the reality. I was reading a piece in Los Angeles Times 2 days ago that looked and said, my God, what are we doing to our children? That huge cat numbers of children are growing up in poverty, are growing up in addicted families, are growing up homeless. I believe it's 50% of black children now are living below the poverty line. One out of every two, like half the people in this auditorium. And the poverty line is the kind of artificial definition that always seems to lag behind reality. I don't know what it is these days. I think it's 8,000 or 9,000. At least where I live, to raise a family of three or four on $8,000 or $9,000 a year, you can't do it. Housing's too expensive. Food's too expensive. Transportation's too expensive. And yet again, we find it so hard to look at the real crises of our time. What happens? The Senate, passes an amendment that says, well, free speech is okay except certain kinds of speech, like burning a flag, because we call that offensive. If free speech is not about the kinds of things that rile us up, it's not about Hallmark cards. It's about stuff. You don't need a First Amendment for free speech about things that aren't controversial. It's not about whether you have the right to say, hello and good morning. It's about the kinds of things that are going to be painful and maybe divisive and maybe going to stir us up. That's what it's there for. Thank God your senator was one of, five or six or seven who had the courage to vote against it and speak out against it and say that that wasn't what he, was defending when he originally believed he was going off to fight in Vietnam. But again, what happens is, it's so hard for our culture to look at those things that actually matter. Now, I say it's hard, and it is hard. I don't think it's impossible, and one of the things that I have been doing, in addition to looking at the barriers, is looking at some of the ways that people indeed have begun to make a change. That's why I call this talk Hope in Hard Times, because I think we have to be honest about the hard times. We also have to be honest about where hope comes from. I don't think it comes from Washington, D.C. I don't think it comes from the President and the Congress and the Senate, except in very rare circumstances. I think it has to come from places like Lincoln, Nebraska. And it occurs, I guess, by people taking on issues that are hard and difficult, that may threaten them, that may threaten our version of the way that the world is supposed to work, but also will address reality. Let me give you a couple examples. There's a woman that I admired a great deal that I wrote about in the book named Hope in Hard Times, who's named Ruth Youngdahl Nelson. She was a very respectable grandmother, in fact, had won the award for the, quote, National Mother of the Year, which is, it's sort of like being on the Quaker Oats box or something. It's, about as up there as you can get. And her brother had been a two-term governor of the state of Minnesota, and another one had been a congressman, and she was very active in the Lutheran Church and had written six or seven books published by the Lutheran Publishing House. And suddenly, at the age of 79, she decides to join in the blockade that's going on of a Trident submarine off the coast of Washington. which is, you know, something that most 79-year-old grandmothers probably don't do. And her son, who's going to be in the blockade, tries to talk her out of it and says something to the effect of, well, you know, Mom, they are threatening 10-year jail terms. You're 79 years old now. I mean, add it up. You could be almost 90 by the time you get out of jail. Let me do it. I'm younger. And, you know, she sort of raised her boy right and wasn't going to take any guff from him. And she said, look, I'm not going to be intimidated and from doing something that I think is right. And she used the phrase, she said the arms race was, quote, obnoxious. I like that phrase. I don't think Henry Kissinger or James Cheney or Bush would really understand what that means. But what it means to me when you say something that was obnoxious, it's like a violation of the way things should be. So it's a violation of kind of all human right and, in her view, of God's law and of the law of nature. And just, we have no right, is what she was saying, to prepare the tools to destroy the world. It's simply not a right that we can take on. And so she gets out there in this little small boat on the water. It has about 30 or 40 of them. And the Coast Guard has this huge flotilla out with helicopters, and they've got Navy destroyers. And I mean, it looked like, I don't know, off the beaches of Normandy or something to stop these 45 people in their rowboats. And they're firing these water cannons at the boats to tip them over into the water so they can't get near the submarine and do things dangerous like, you know, offer bread to the sailors or something. And they're firing these essentially high-pressure hoses. And this young Coast Guardsman who's maybe 18 years old aims this water cannon at her boat that was being driven by her son. And she turns and she does a very interesting thing. She shakes her finger at him, you know, like that. You know, like, I don't know if anybody's been ever scolded by your grandma like that. Or there see a few people who might be grandmas here who maybe have scolded their grandchildren like that. And that was sort of the way that she did it. And she says, you know, in her best grandmotherly voice, young man. And she says, please, in my America, don't do that. And he stops. And he backs down, and he just, you know, doesn't fire the water cannon. And it's such an interesting moment because, you know, obviously something's touched him. Something's touched his spirit from this stand of courage that this grandmother has taken. And she's also framing herself in a very interesting way. When she says, not in my America, don't do that, she's saying, you know, I'm an inhabitant. I live here. I have a right. Don't call me some outsider. Don't dismiss me. You know, treat me as somebody who has a stake in this future. And that is the way that I think we all have to begin to frame our actions. Now, I'm not saying that most of us are going to end up risking 10 years in jail. I mean, that's a daunting prospect. But that we will have to do things that at some point scare us, even if it's just raising your hand for a question in a classroom or writing a letter to the newspaper or starting a conversation in a dorm or a fraternity or a sorority. Those things are frightening. Maybe they're more frightening to us than the getting in the rowboat and risking 10 years in jail was to the grandmother. But that's part of what has to be done to make it a participatory society. And again, it happens in lots of ways. I have some friends at the University of Michigan who started a group called Greeks for Peace, which may sound like a contradiction in terms, but they didn't think it was so. They were members of various fraternities and sororities, and they became active. One person took a class on Central American politics and was very concerned about that issue. Another person got involved in some of the anti-apartheid things that were going on. They were volunteering at there's a graduate student who decided to take on the local highly entrenched congressman and actually almost scored an upset victory. And they were volunteering, and all of a sudden they noticed, you know, hey, there's a bunch of other people who have addresses on Greek Row. We're not the only ones who feel this way. And it seemed to me that they had a fundamental choice at that point. One possibility was that Michigan's a very historically active campus, and they could move off into one of the sort of, quote, hippie dorms, or they could move off to an apartment. They could essentially huddle together with people who were of similar mind. And that's not always bad to have that kind of support community. But they decided to stay where they were in their respective frats and sororities and work with the people who they knew and were friends with. And I remember it was about a year later, that they had started this group called Greeks for Peace, and there was a chapter, I forget the name of it, it was the oldest sorority in America. And it had the building had the beautiful, like, white columns and upholstery with matching drapes and matching carpets and matching chairs, and the house mother looked like she could have been from the Daughters of the American Revolution. And I mean, it was pretty pristine. And there was a student talking in the lounge that of that sorority, who's a medical student from the University of San Salvador in El Salvador. And he was talking about how the National Guard that the U.S. had supported and trained had gone in to his university, closed the university down, murdered the head of the university, the rector, murdered a great deal of students and professors, had others lying on the ground with bayonets in their backs, not knowing if they're going to be able to ever take another breath in their life, including him. That was hard stuff to deal with. But what he was saying is, this is a choice that was made. And it was a choice that was made in Washington, D.C., that continues to be made in Washington, D.C. I mean, you know, El Salvador gets a tremendous amount of U.S. aid. I think it's the third or fourth largest of any nation we give money to. I mean, it's a tiny, tiny country. That absolutely shattered thousands and thousands and hundreds of thousands of lives in his country. It's a choice we didn't have to make. And he was saying that there's some connection between the action or inaction of people there in that community and what was going on in El Salvador. And what was interesting is, not that that dialogue was completely absent on the University of Michigan campus, it wasn't. You know, that person would have spoken at another hall or another dorm would be conceivable. But it never reached the fraternities or the sororities. And that there were 60 or 70 people sitting around talking and thinking, that was tremendously consequential, and it happened because those people took the effort and the risk to try and bring these larger questions into where they lived. I remember when I was at Stanford during the Vietnam War, a very interesting thing happened during my dorm, and that was that one of the RAs made this proposal. We used some dorm funds to give money to something called Medical Aid for Indochina that was trying to rebuild a hospital that the U.S. had bombed in the north. And it was a combination of a humanitarian statement sending medicine and medical technologies to help people. And it was also a very directly political statement that said, we do not consider ourselves at war with these people. And the choice to use dorm funds was interesting. There were about 100 people in the dorm. And we had a fairly decent-sized budget of maybe $10 apiece. So it was a $1,000 budget. And I believe they were suggesting we allocate $50, 50 cents apiece. Because it was everybody's money, people had to make a common decision. Because they had to make a common decision, there was debate and discussion, because not everybody by any means thought it was a good idea. And people talked back and forth for a couple weeks. People who never talked about these kinds of issues. Was it right? Was it wrong? Was it giving aid and comfort to the enemy? Was it helping to end the war? Was it helping ordinary human beings? All these questions that, again, are the stuff of politics. And it did indeed finally pass by a fairly sizable margin. But what was interesting to me is that the process by which it occurred was probably even more important than the money. Perhaps something analogous could happen with the hurricane relief for Nicaragua, or there's a medical aid now for El Salvador. I know that when I was at St. Olaf's College in downstate Minnesota last spring, they had a run where basically the cross-country team and people from just, you know, dorms, men and women from the school, did a five-mile run with different teams to, again, raise money for Nicaraguan hurricane relief. It was interesting because you didn't normally see the constituents of school jocks heading out on political issues, but again, they had to think about it. What I'm suggesting is that a lot of the choices we have to do with how we can weave politics into our daily community, how we can weave these larger ethical choices. I remember being in a small South Carolina town with a Baptist preacher who was very long-standing in the community. His great-great-great-grandfather had died in the Revolutionary War, and his dad had the Buick Pontiac dealership, and he was this good Rotarian and good Baptist preacher, and suddenly gets worried about the arms race, and he starts wanting to do something, and so he doesn't know what to do. There's no Nebraskans for Peace. There's no Sane Freeze. There's no AFSC. There's none of the groups that there's probably, I would guess, in a city like Lincoln, 8 or 10 or 12 or maybe even 40 groups working on peace and justice issues. There weren't any in Florence, South Carolina. It was a small country town. And so he doesn't know what to do. He calls somebody who he remembered writing a letter to the local paper on the MX, and he says, "Y'all don't know me, but I'm concerned about these same things. Let's go and meet." And so they start beginning to meet and have a dialogue. They take a film from the Physicians for Social Responsibility, and they send it around. They show it at the First Baptist Church and the Ebenezer Baptist Church and the Jewish Temple and the Presbyterian Church and the Garden Club and the PTA and every group they can find. Sometimes the response isn't so good. This guy, preacher Bill Cusack, was a Rotarian and longstanding, and we brought it to the Rotary Club. He said, like, they wouldn't talk to him for 6 months, you know. They finally started making jokes about it and asking him what he thought about the news. It had an effect, but sometimes there's a little bit of a breach first. There's a lot of ways these things can happen. I don't know if anything equivalent is going on here, but in the state of Oregon, there's now a statewide curriculum dealing with these kinds of global nuclear age questions that the state board, you know, the legislature drew up, had a committee draw up, and the different school districts are trying it out and modifying it and debating it and using it so that when somebody goes through 12 years of school, they don't come out separated from the world. So they have a chance to talk about these issues. I would suggest that something equivalent could be done in Nebraska. Might even be the support for it. Oregon has two Republican senators. It's not exactly the most radical state in the Union. It seems to me that there's a great many things we can do. Many of them are happening. They have to do with transforming the institutions we're part of, like a school. You know, what is it that we study in our curriculums? Can we take a hand in it? Can we work collaboratively, students, faculty, administrators, to say, what are the issues we need to deal with? I know the University of North Dakota has a president who is a highly decorated World War II vet who has, in his words, I guess he's just seen too much of war. And one of the things he's pushing for is a universal peace studies minor for every student at that school. And he says, look, we may not all agree on how we approach these issues, but we've damn well got to deal with them. That's an interesting model. There are a lot of things that can be done. Some of the debates around cultural diversity, that we live in a society that is not all entirely white, that is not all entirely coming from the same backgrounds. How do we prepare ourselves for that world? Schools are beginning to take these issues on. Again, it's not always so easy, but it involves a shift towards taking responsibility. One of the things that's very much encouraged me as of late is there's been a growth of these, I guess they call themselves community service centers, at schools all across the country. And I was at a week-long gathering in Minneapolis this summer where students talked about having these centers that sent their peers into the community to work with homeless shelters, to work with Big Brother programs, tutoring programs, soup kitchens, a lot of different ways to link with their communities. And it seemed to me, and in fact seemed to some of the students there as well, that this was not sufficient, that they had to not only ask, okay, how do I serve a sandwich to somebody who is in need? They had to say, why is that person in need in the first place? Why in a country this affluent do we put up with the, well, let me call it a fundamental sin of allowing people to go hungry? They had to ask those questions and they had to address the structures behind them. But they saw those centers as ways of bringing people in a step at a time, of making it possible to at least connect with some world beyond what's on the nightly soaps, a real world. I mean, of sitting there and watching people, you know, whose jackets are torn and whose eyes are a little bit glazed because they've been wandering the streets and haven't slept right in a nice, comfortable bed, because they don't always open the refrigerator, go into the dorm cafeteria and simply get the food, because there isn't always food. These are things that are troubling to deal with. And yet I think that I see a current of students beginning to take them on. I'm very heartened by that. It seems to me that perhaps the best way to frame these questions is in terms of what I would call interlocking choices. And let me throw out a few words. The notion of peace, the notion of justice, the notion of sustainability. If you have a world that is spending its capital on weapon systems and cannot afford to feed its children or treat its children from preventable disease, that is some fundamental crime. If you can have a society like ours that can spend $100 billion projected on the B-2 bomber and can spend, I believe it's $22 billion on all the education of the federal grants, you know, to every level, there is something wrong with those priorities. If you have a world that chews up its resources in a way that they cannot be sustained and just assumes that somehow our magic technologies will solve things, there's something wrong with that. We're not looking at the future. I'm not anti-technological. I'm probably as addicted to computers as any single person I know. But I think that we have to say, where do the technologies have their uses? Where do they, how do they fit into the kinds of communities that we're trying to build? Not just blindly accept everything that's handed down as inevitable progress. And these are hard questions. They're very hard questions. And I don't think any of us are going to solve them by ourselves, and I don't think any of us are going to solve them instantly. But it seems to me that if we begin to take them on, if we begin to ask, how do we stop the erosion of our topsoils? How do we have an agriculture that can continue on for generations without chewing up the base of the land? How do we support the family farms? How do we achieve peace in the world without threatening to destroy each other? How do we make manifest the right of other countries, independent countries, to go their own way, whether they be Nicaragua? I mean, here we are overtly putting in now $12.5 million to try and buy their elections. What does that mean? How would we feel if they, you know, the Saudis or the Iranians or the Libyans poured in, let's be proportionate here, $100 million to try and elect George Bush or Michael Dukakis? I don't think we'd like that very much. You know, again, there are shifts in this world that are encouraging. The Soviets are pulling out of Afghanistan where they had no right to be and where they wreaked such devastation. It's an acknowledging by them of some kinds of limits. I think our country needs to really grapple with those limits, and we need to speak out. We need to encourage those who do speak out, who supposedly represent us. And we have to have that dialogue in the communities that says, again, what are we here for? And it seems to me that hard as these things are, there is something to be gained from them as well. I know when I'm comparing the lives of the people at Hanford, who were certainly comfortable, who were certainly well-fed and had every toy that they could imagine to work with, there was still something missing. What was missing is that fundamental dialogue. And when I compared those peace activists who were often beleaguered and often frustrated, and things didn't always happen in the time that we wanted them to happen, nonetheless, they were wrestling with what mattered. It gave them a satisfaction. And I would suggest that when we view our lives, we should view them in those terms and ask, what issues do I care passionately about? How can I think them through? How can I connect them to other issues in this complicated world that we live in? And how can I begin to make a difference and to make the society more humane so that when our grandchildren come along, they will find a world that we have prepared for them that is a world of dignity, and that is a world of justice, and that is a world that is worthy of the gifts that we have as human beings from living on this earth. Thanks.
Today on University Forum, we've heard author Paul Loeb. His lecture was entitled Hope in Hard Times. This has been University Forum, a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University. Nebraska Wesleyan is a private undergraduate liberal arts university located in Lincoln, Nebraska. Approximately 1,300 full-time students are enrolled in more than 40 programs at the university.